You're with John Cleary on ABC Local Radio and on Radio Australia.
And thank you for joining us on Sunday night. Well, as promised last week and mentioned earlier this evening, we now turn to the second of our specials. Today, two former popes were made saints, John the 23rd and John Paul II. Last week, we looked at John the 23rd. Tonight's program is an encounter with John Paul II, All the World's a Stage. John Paul II was Pope for 26 years. Credited with bringing down Soviet communism, he was also the most travelled Pope in history. And between 1978 and 2004, he became a household name like no Pope before him. A celebrity Pope for a celebrity age. Well, on the eve of his canonisation by the Vatican, Noel Debien asked what forces shaped the man and what sort of legacy did he leave the world?
Pope John Paul II ends his visit to Egypt later today with a trip to Mount Sinai.
This morning in Jakarta, Pope John Paul has begun his
visit. Pope John Paul will leave New Delhi today for an 8-day tour of the centres of Christianity.
On the second day of the Pope's tour of Chile,
the Big Apple welcomes John Paul II.
The Pope has arrived in Canada and 27,000.
A crowd of thousands.
20,000.
4 million.
More than a million banner-waving Filipinos.
The largest crowd ever assembled to see the Pope.
Cheering, stomping and sometimes tearful high school students who came to see the man they were told had a way with people.
John Paul II, the celebrity pope. A name up there with Princess Di, Michael Jackson, Ronald Reagan and Mikhail Gorbachev. He visited 129 countries, travelled more than a million kilometres. He was seen in the flesh by more people than anyone ever before in human history, or since. Aspiring actor as a young man, as pope he strode the world stage and knew how to work a crowd. There hasn't been such a successful Christian missionary contact since St. Paul, who first internationalised the church beyond its Jewish beginnings. In 1978, Pope John Paul inherited a church in crisis. 26 years later, opinion was divided over whether he left it in better shape.
To those who have wandered from their spiritual home, I wish to say, come back. The church opens her arms to you. The church loves you.
He brought to the Vatican what Ronald Reagan brought to the White House, a media-wise great communicator who will understand how to use his charm, his athletic image, his symbolic gestures to make even the most conservative teaching or practice seem palatable.
He was exotic to me. I think he was actually a very sexy man. I could see that he had a great deal of charisma, full of life, beautiful sparkling eyes and everything. I found it quite a paradox about him. I respected him on several things, and I absolutely did not respect him on other things.
He left us with the notion that a woman's foot is not fit matter for washing on Holy Thursday.
He supported the witch hunt against innovators and dissidents, especially against unruly theologians in Europe and North America, and against the liberation theologians of Latin America.
I stole a line from Charles Dickens and described this papacy of John Paul II as the best of times and the worst of times.
...1978 was a torrid time for popes. The year Italian Catholic Prime Minister Aldo Moro was assassinated, despite Pope Paul begging for his life. In Sydney, there was the first gay and lesbian solidarity march, Mardi Gras. Louise Brown, the first test tube baby, was born. And Italy legalised abortion. 98% of Americans owned a TV, the first ever mobile phone was produced. Greece, Saturday Night Fever and Close Encounters of the Third Kind were the box office hits. The Grammy song of the year was Barbra Streisand's love theme from A Star Is Born. Clifford Longley, now lead writer and editorial consultant on the UK's Catholic weekly The Tablet, was religion correspondent at the Times of London.
The election of Karol Wojtyła happened, if you remember, when the church was in a severe state of trauma. It had elected Pope John Paul I. All the people who took part in that election came away saying to themselves, we've done the right thing. We've been guided by the Holy Spirit. We have found the one person that God wants to lead the Catholic Church. Then he dies. Well, what does that tell you? I think they were in a state of panic. I think they looked for a strong man. They looked for a charismatic figure. They looked, above all, for a healthy man. And I would have thought Wojtyła was probably the healthiest man in that conclave by a long way. So he wasn't about to do the same thing. He had a sense of strength. He had a sense of purpose. He had a sense of knowing who he was and of knowing what he wanted to do. And they were particularly vulnerable, it seemed to me, because of electing Pope John Paul I, who died.
Clifford Longley. Pope John Paul II's personal biographer is American George Weigel. He knew Karol Wojtyła for 15 years.
He was an utterly normal human being, as vaguely blasphemous as that might sound. He had a robust sense of humor. He had absolutely no use for sycophants at all. He liked to kid, and he liked to be kidded. He was a man of the most intense curiosity I think I have ever encountered. He always wanted to know what was going on, literarily, intellectually, cinematically, musically. He was a man of extraordinarily broad culture who never really looked in the rearview mirror. He was always looking out the windscreen. He was always looking forward.
The first Slav Pope was born in 1920 Poland. His hometown was Wadowice. It had a large Jewish community, and it was just 35 k's from Auschwitz. His mum died when he was 9, his only brother when he was 12. The Nazis marched into Poland when he was 19, and his father died suddenly 18 months later. His parish priests were arrested the same year, and defying the Nazis, he became a seminarian secretly a year later. It was 1942, and just a few months later, a fellow clandestine seminarian was arrested and shot dead by the Gestapo. George Weigel, John Paul's personal biographer again.
For over 5 years, he lived under draconian conditions of Nazi occupation, in which, as one of his friends put it to me, it was not a question of knowing whether you would be alive next Christmas or on your next birthday. It was not knowing for over 5 years whether you would be alive tomorrow morning. That kind of pressure did different things to different people. What it did for Karol Wojtyła was that it formed someone of remarkable luminosity, someone who was hard enough and sharp enough to cut through things that seemed impermeable, like the Berlin Wall. I don't think you can overestimate the importance of the experience of the war in forging the man who became the priest, who became the Archbishop of Krakow, who became the Pope.
I think his Polishness was crucial. Poland's a very particular kind of Catholicism and a very particular national story. He survived during the absolutely horrendous Nazi occupation of Poland, where Poles, Slavs like him, were treated as somehow subhuman individuals, not quite as subhuman as the Jews, but getting there. He saw all that. He survived it very heroically, as a matter of fact, and wouldn't for 1 minute criticize the way he conducted himself during the war, including the way he befriended Jews who very desperately needed friends at that time. But then, of course, he survived the period of Soviet communism when Poland was part of the Soviet Empire and communism was imposed on this very Catholic nation. And I think those experiences really dictated his mindset, not just when he was Archbishop of Krakow, but when he was Pope. If you like, he hadn't really seen the world except through that lens of a Polish church surviving because of its faith, because of its commitment, because of the role of Our Lady, for example. He was very much devoted, as a Pole Catholic would be, to the figure of the Mother of Christ. In those respects, it was very much a Polish cultural Catholicism that he saw as the normative version of Catholicism It was not a good time for diversity, and the Catholic Church suffered from that.
Clifford Longley. Karol Wojtyła was 58 when elected. The first pope from behind the Iron Curtain, he would help tear it down.
Polish bishops have declared Poland's population is being terrorised by military force. And now to Poland and the Pope's tour of his homeland.
There have been no shots of the crowds, which have everywhere been vast, or their response, which has been by turns fervent, reverent and ecstatic. The nature of the Polish state, communist, atheist and republican, has been temporarily transformed.
The Communist Party began retreating from power a year ago. The break with communist rule is the most serious fracture so far in the bloc of communist countries set up in Eastern Europe at the end of the Second World War.
The Soviet Union is dead, and in its place a Commonwealth which claims not to be a state stands ready to tackle ethnic violence and the move to a market-based economy.
If you ask yourself, why did this seemingly very powerful system collapse in Europe when it did, 1989 rather than 1999 or 2009 or 2019 or whatever, and why did it collapse the way it did, nonviolently, in the main? I think you have to give full credit to the revolution of conscience that swept through Central and Eastern Europe in the 1980s. And at the center of that revolution of conscience was John Paul II. It would not be really possible to imagine, say, a Mexican pope igniting in Poland what John Paul II ignited in June 1979. It took someone who knew that culture from the inside, who knew all of the historical imagery, the literary imagery, the deep meanings embedded in a very rich and complex language, which he deployed like a master, to bring hope to people who often found their situation hopeless. And at the center of that revolution of conscience was John Paul II and his visit to Poland in June 1979. Those 9 days ignited tinder that had been prepared by brave dissidents for years and decades before that, but somebody had to put the spark in the tinder. And I think that's what John Paul II did. And I think the Soviet Union knew that's exactly what it did, which is why some 2 years later, we had the assassination attempt of May 1981.
May the 13th, 1981. St. Peter's Square, Rome, 5:17 in the afternoon. An assassin has shot one of the world's greatest religious leaders.
An assassination attempt has been made on the life of Pope John Paul II in the Vatican City. First reports say he was seen to fall by eyewitnesses after the shots, and he's now been taken to hospital.
Over the next 10 years, he visited Poland 3 more times. The communist government fell, and Solidarity, the union movement, won 3 elections. Then he invited Soviet Premier Gorbachev to the Vatican. Gorbachev came, and they established formal diplomatic relations. A year later, the communists relinquished power in the Soviet Union. He'd been a busy pope. A fond childhood memory for Karol Wojtyła was listening to the Jewish Kol Nidre prayer chanted on Yom Kippur. His dad had taken him to the synagogue. Karol had grown up with Jewish friends in Wadowice. As a kid, he ate with them in their homes, and he observed their festivals. One of the first things he did as Pope was visit the Nazi death camp at Auschwitz. He prayed for the mother of his childhood friend Regina Beer, and the mother and grandmother and sister of friend Jerzy Kluger. They all died in the gas chambers. St. Peter apart, John Paul II became the first pope in history to visit Rome's chief synagogue and to visit Israel. Rabbi David Rosen helped establish formal diplomatic relations between modern Israel and the Vatican.
Certainly the personal experience was very significant for John Paul II, but it was an experience, of course, of his childhood, and it was an experience also of shared suffering. For him, the Shoah, the Holocaust, was not an event that happened somewhere far away to people of some other community. It was part of his own tragedy, of his own family tragedy, of his own national tragedy. And he saw the suffering of the Jews and the suffering of the Poles he saw as inextricably related. This, of course, to some extent created problems for those Jews who felt that they had also suffered at the hands of Poles. But nevertheless, for John Paul II, this suffering, in a sense, was a further bond. It was a bond beyond even the friendships and familiarity of his own childhood with the Jewish community. And therefore, the Catholic-Jewish relationship was, as it were, literally in his flesh. It was something that was part of his daily breath. It was a part of his own persona, of his own very character and being. And it was profoundly committed to it. And that's why these gestures were important to him, as well as being so enormously consequential for the Catholic-Jewish relationship. The accusation that is not just levelled against John Paul II, but against many elements within the church in general concerning this so-called Christianization of the Shoah is in effect a claim by certain Jewish elements that the Jewish people has some kind of exclusive ownership over this tragedy. I can't take such a claim seriously. Of course, this tragedy was an enormous tragedy for the Jewish people, and there was no particular people that had to so systematically be exterminated as much as the Jewish people in Hitler's eyes and those of his acolytes and collaborators. But the Jewish people was not the only people to suffer this terrible tragedy. I think this claim is totally lacking in serious respect and certainly totally out of the realm of any serious interreligious communication and mutual respect and sensitivity for the traditions and heritages of other people.
Catholicism had a very serious problem of anti-Semitism, particularly in its heartlands, European heartlands and Eastern Europe. This was something that provided fertile ground for Nazi racist anti-Semitic philosophy. I mean, it wasn't inevitable that it happened, but it did happen the way it did. Now, at no point am I aware that John Paul II was tainted by anti-Semitism. On the contrary, he was heroically opposed to anti-Semitism. He did things that put himself at risk to save Jews personally. We don't know a lot about it, but we know bits of it, and it all fits into a picture. And he understood, I think, that the key figures in the Gospels, all of them were Jewish, including, of course, the mother of our Lord, who was his special favorite. He made tackling residual anti-Semitism in the Catholic Church an important priority. He went to Jerusalem and he inserted a letter, prayer, if you like, to Almighty God, apologizing quite categorically for all the things that had been done against the Jews in the name of the Church and in the name of Jesus Christ. The possibility of Catholicism ever returning to its pre-conciliar, pre-council anti-Semitism, I think, has been taken off the table.
You're on ABC Radio. I'm Noel Debien, and you're listening to All the World's a Stage, an encounter with Pope John Paul II. The council Clifford Longley's referring to is Vatican II. John Paul attended it as a young bishop, and as Pope took up its new direction on world religions quite powerfully. In 1985, he spoke to 80,000 young Muslims in Casablanca. Dr. William O'Malley wrote the book, What Happened at Vatican II.
Under John Paul II's pontificate, I think you had two aspects of how the council was carried on or not carried on. The first aspect was his attitude and actions to outside the church, and especially to Jews and Muslims. What the document on non-Christian religions did, it gave the church a new mission, a mission of reconciliation among religions. And John Paul II was marvelous in that regard. And his actions regarding the Jews and his contact with the Jews are well known, but also with the Muslims. So in that way, John Paul II was a very powerful implementer of the Second Vatican Council. When you're speaking now of internal to the church, he came out of a siege situation, and in Poland, behind the Iron Curtain, everybody had to sing the same song, because if you didn't, there would be no song to sing. So he wanted the church to present a clear, unified, unquestioned facade of gaze to the world.
John Paul's wish for the world to see an unquestioned, unified Catholic gaze wasn't unanimously accepted in the Western world. The culture of Polish students he knew in his first uni chaplaincy job was a very different world from the young people he met in Western Europe. On his first papal visit to West Germany in 1980, and in front of 500,000 people in Munich, young German woman Barbara Engel actually challenged him in public.
Heiliger Vater.
Holy Father. You have responded in your sermon to many things that affect us. But for us young people, the Church in Germany is often hard to understand. Young people have the impression that the Church clings anxiously to the status quo, that it focuses once again on the differences between the Catholic and Protestant churches rather than the similarities, and that it answers young people's questions about friendship, sexuality and partnership with what is not allowed, what is forbidden. So our search for understanding and our wish for the Church to engage in open dialogue is not being met.
Dass wir suchen nach Verständnis und Gesprächsbereitschaft zu wenig Antwort findet.
The Church had been struggling for a decade with widespread internal revolt over artificial birth control. Young people were commonly living together. Not only nuns had changed their habits. To many ordinary people, the Church teachings weren't common sense, and increasingly, faith became a matter for the individual. Australian broadcaster Geraldine Doogue.
You know, I suppose I have a really deep-seated commitment to the notion that the Church mustn't be afraid of the world around it. Or if it is sufficiently afraid, if it sees such a really deeply unethical impulses, it has to get in there. But I thought there were some wonderful things let loose in those years when JP2 was around, and I felt that he was deeply worried. I thought he misread the signs of the times. He was clearly a man of faith. I really do think that is something that was a wonderful modelling that he offered. But he was deeply afraid of a lot of the urges of the world.
How do you come to terms as a practicing Catholic that you've made decisions which are not in accord with central magisterium? And how do you square your relationship to authority, to priesthood and authority within the Church now?
Well, with effort and after a great deal of thinking about it. I think, again, it started with my mother having very full and frank discussions about whoever was the parish priest in our midst or the assistant priest. And Mum used to believe that you weren't sentenced to your parish priest, that you shopped around. Now, that was not a very common view. She said they're just men.
Australian broadcaster Geraldine Doogue.
Church does not heed the views of women.
If a person's right to life is violated at the moment in which he is first conceived,
the Catholic Church needs to change its doctrinal position on condoms, or people will continue to die.
The pill raises new issues not thought of when previous statements were made. The Church should re-examine its traditional thinking on contraception.
In the 1960s, Karol Wojtyła was a Catholic progressive on sex. Love and Responsibility was his first major book on it, and it's very frank. He'd specialised in sexual ethics, researching, writing and teaching extensively on it, with input from his university students. Pope Paul had appointed Karol to the Papal Birth Control Commission in the 60s because he knew of Bishop Wojtyła's interest and his pro-life convictions.
He certainly broke new ground in Catholic thinking about our being embodied as men and women, the complementarity and fruitfulness built into that, the theology of the body that he articulated in 5 years of audience addresses in the late 70s and early 1980s is really one of the most remarkable bodies of papal teaching in the modern era. It's fundamentally reshaping marriage preparation programs here in the United States. I have yet to visit a university campus over the past 10 years where there is not a theology of the body discussion group going on. He's appealed to young people. That, too, all came out of this experience of university chaplaincy. He was in no sense a prudish man. He understood that medicine, psychology, psychiatry had things to teach us about the dynamics of human love, and he was not shy about consulting professionals in those fields and then bringing what he learned from that to bear in his preaching and writing on matters of marriage and family life.
Karol Wojtyła's understanding of sex had been influenced by his close friend, Dr. Wanda Paltowska. Together they'd set up scores of natural family planning clinics through the Archdiocese of Krakow. During World War II, Wanda was in Ravensbrück concentration camp. The SS performed fertility experimentation on her for 4 years and left her for dead. She watched routine execution of newborn babies. After the war, she became a psychiatrist. Karol knew what the Nazis had done to her.
What Wojtyła created in Krakow with the help of Wanda Paltowska and others was a method of resistance against the communist deconstruction of marriage and the family.
By 1979, Karol was very aware of other modern state interventions like the one-child policy in China and forced sterilizations in India and other places.
Any reasonable person who understands what biology and genetics teach us, that the product of human conception is a human creature, will be necessarily pro-life. Wanda Paltowska understood that as a woman of science. She also saw what happened in the Nazi period when the state arrogates to itself the right to claim that certain members of the human community are outside the boundaries of legal protection. What you get is wickedness on an unparalleled scale. So the two of those worked together to develop in her a great passion for the pro-life cause. What he tried to do was ask people to reconsider, ask people to think again. It's very important to underscore here that the Catholic Church does not teach an ideology of fertility at all costs. The Catholic Church teaches that couples have a moral responsibility to plan their families. The question turns on what are the morally and humanly appropriate ways for family planning. And the Church's settled position is that the natural rhythms of the body provide the most humane way to exercise moral responsibility in family planning. These points are almost universally missed in media coverage of these very delicate questions. And I think it's important to underscore them here. And if we look, for example, at a Western world that is systematically depopulating itself today in a way that is unprecedented in human history, I think we can understand that the oral contraceptive pill was, with the splitting of the atom and the unraveling of the DNA double helix, one of the three great world historical scientific events of the 20th century. And its social impacts are not universally positive at all.
I think that Pope John Paul II's interest in question of human relationships and sexual relationships gave it an importance, which it probably hadn't received before. But that's not to say that his solutions were the right ones. He had a particular philosophy which he brought to bear on these questions, and it hasn't had the legacy it should have had if he was right. And it is conspicuously the case that vast numbers of lay Catholics, including people who are very devout and very committed to their faith, do not buy the sort of line on sexuality that he was promoting. They didn't recognize the world he was talking about as the world they were living in.
You're on ABC Radio. I'm Noel Debien, and you're listening to All the World's a Stage, an encounter with Pope John Paul II. Dissent among lay Catholics was a new phenomenon beyond clergy control. But dissent among bishops and theologians, now that was another matter. Time magazine correspondent Robert Blair Kaiser explains.
The communism that he knew was an overwhelmingly negative thing that leaned on the Polish people and put them under a terrible, cruel regime. That was his concrete experience of communism. Then here come these Latin American theologians saying a lot of the same things that the communists were saying in Poland about the need for a reform of society.
It started with Holland, but it became a more general concern, and he was concerned about the United States, where Catholicism seemed to him to be dancing with dangerous ideas, liberation theology, for example. Though he personally placed great emphasis on social justice, I think he saw that as a distraction from the church's main job, which was to get, crudely, bums on pews, to make sure that good Catholics went to Mass, that sort of thing, and that they kept the rules. It seems to me that he decided, as a matter of policy, that when some of the giants of the Second Vatican Council retired, they would be replaced by much more conservative figures, rather than a successor of the same kind. And so gradually, the hierarchies all over the world were pulled towards a more conservative kind of Catholicism, which was more concerned with, if you like, obedience to rules, particularly where sexuality was concerned, and less concerned with social justice. So he had a very strong influence, because he was there for so long, in shifting the tone of the hierarchy internationally in a much more conservative direction.
Tablet journalist Clifford Longley. John Paul II put a stop to liberation theology. He banned priests from direct political activity. Their job was spiritual and moral leadership, he said. Swiss theologian Hans Küng had his Catholic theology license taken from him for questioning papal infallibility. He wasn't the only one.
Reverend Charles Curran, an American professor of theology and critic of John Paul II, was sacked from the Catholic University in Washington.
There's been a lot of silencing of theologians.
There's no doubt that Catholics are a little worried about speaking out on some controversial issues.
A lot of disciplinary action against theologians of one sort or another, and a strong pulling into line.
Another person who copped it was English nun Lavinia Byrne. She'd published an untimely book about women priests in 1994, the same year Pope John Paul banned all discussion.
I wrote that book, Woman at the Altar, in 1992-3. Nothing happened till 4 or 5 years later, when the CDF, the congregation, came after me and they attacked the order I belonged to and made life extremely difficult for my religious superiors. Now, they never told Cardinal Basil Hume, the British cardinal at the time, that they were researching me. Do you know, the sense of natural justice, of confronting people who accuse you, and of being able to lay your case before them, that was something I could never access. The people in Rome who condemned me never met me, never invited me to go and sit down with them, face them, explain my case. So my sense of natural justice was totally frustrated. I never felt I was given a fair hearing.
Cardinal Hume was a great defender of yours. He went on record. He really did speak strongly in your favour, didn't he? Tell us about that.
I saw the Cardinal in the year 1978. I met up with the Cardinal with the provincial superior of my order, the sister in charge of all the nuns in the UK. And he was extraordinarily kind to me. He said he was angry because something had been done on his patch, which he had no knowledge of. And he was cross that he hadn't been approached. It had been done behind his back.
Ex-nun and BBC broadcaster Lavinia Byrne. Meanwhile, despite John Paul's efforts to get all Catholics singing from the same hymn sheet, his approach on women priests triggered concern over Catholic attitudes to women generally. Joan Chittister is an American Benedictine sister.
Where the modernization of the church was, he never even mentioned women. I mean, he left us with the notion that a woman's foot is not fit matter for washing on Holy Thursday. Now, that is no legacy I would want to be left with in this century. At the same time, it would be unfair not to note that he's also the only pope in the history of the church who has ever written an encyclical on women. His encyclical, Mulieris Dignitatem, he wrote it to end the question, ironically, but what it managed to do was really open the question of the role of women in the church. It's a very confused document, but we must be grateful for the fact that it was written at all.
John Paul did write the first ever papal encyclical on women, but one legacy of that letter, called Mulieris Dignitatem in Latin, was to be Pope Benedict's launch of a tough Vatican investigation into all American nuns, 60,000 of them. It wasn't a popular move with the sisters. Sister Joan Chittister remembers.
The confusion in Mulieris Dignitatem carries over into this very study. This study is launched, apparently, out of a concern, their words, not mine, that women religious had become, quote, radical feminists. I've never heard a more embarrassing statement from the church in the modern world than that one. It is embarrassingly incorrect. If anything proves they know nothing about what they're talking about, it's that phrase alone. They're treating feminism as if it's not just a heresy, but a monolith.
I actually think myself there's still a small minority, is what my judgment would be, of Catholics devote much attention at all to the notion of women priests. But I think what utterly exercised them was the futility of this man exercising an authority that actually he didn't have anymore. You know, the very best politicians have schooled me into saying you never test authority that you don't have. It's a most unwise exercise. And I felt that what occurred progressively in JP2's reign is that they steadily sounded more and more like they were shouting into the abyss. They didn't have the authority.
Live from Sydney, the ABC's Late Line. Here's Maxine McHugh.
The Polish-born Karol Wojtyła has presided over a pontificate that has centralised power to such an extent that he has given a new lease of life to the notion of the papal monarchy.
The church became very dependent on him. They became very centralised. He made all the appointments. He decided what ideas were in and what ideas were out. The Pope was also very clever, I may add, by the way. He is probably brighter than any of his advisers. So we have, if you like, one mind in the Catholic Church, and it was his mind, and woe betide anybody who didn't agree with him.
But Pope John Paul wasn't a one-man band. Cardinal Joseph Ratzinger, later Pope Benedict, always had his back. The German cardinal was the enforcer from the Curia, always right behind him, and the Vatican bureaucracy liked their conservative leadership.
Although not an Italian, John Paul II was very much to the liking of the Roman Curia, since he came from a country where neither the Reformation nor the Enlightenment had produced lasting effects.
Under John Paul II, the greater centralization of the church in the Roman Curia and in the papacy itself and the Pope himself was a move away from what Vatican II was trying to do. Vatican II wanted a more shared responsibility, and it wanted to allow the church to grow and blossom and take on its different hues, you might say, on the local scene. I mean, this is especially true with, say, bishops of Africa and Asia, who generally felt that under John Paul II that they were not listened to in that regard. So, yes, as I understand the Second Vatican Council, that was certainly a move away.
Shifting the tone of the hierarchy internationally had, I think, one fundamental catastrophic consequence. These were exactly the wrong men to deal with the child abuse crisis when it broke, and they made exactly the wrong decisions, defending the church's name, which to them would have been the paramount thing because of who they were and what they felt their role was. And in fact, it wasn't defending the church's name, it was defending victims that should have come first. But that, if you like, was too progressive an idea, and I fear that the church's colossal mistakes with which it has by no means recovered.
America is where the sexual abuse crisis really blew up, first in Boston. America has a culture of free press, critique of institutions. So at first, the Vatican thought clerical abuse was an American problem, just a beat-up caused by a hostile press. Sex abuse had been identified as a problem by the Vatican in 1962, and absolute church-protecting secrecy was enforced under Pope John XXIII, a ruling that was signed by counter-reforming Cardinal Ottaviani. The secrecy, of course, allowed clergy to get away with blue murder.
He always claimed the power. With power goes responsibility.
Hans Hermann Gruhe is the most senior priest to have resigned over child abuse in the last 50 years. He's been Cardinal Archbishop of Vienna for a decade. As a theological conservative, Gruhe had been a favorite of Pope John Paul II.
Father Marcial Maciel built the conservative Legion of Christ into a powerful Catholic order. After Maciel died in 2008, his order revealed that he had fathered a daughter. Others have come forward claiming to be his sons.
There were years of allegations ignored by the Vatican that Father Maciel sexually abused seminarians as young as 12.
He was a notorious child molester, he was a morphine addict, and he used money to secure power.
Así como al padre Marcial Maciel.
I would not say that John Paul II and Maciel were friends. Maciel certainly liked to claim that. I'm not sure that's an accurate description of the character of the relationship. But having said that, I think it's very clear that John Paul II was deceived by Father Maciel, who was a master deceiver, who deceived the richest man in the world, Carlos Slim, who deceived many, many right-minded and upright people for decades, who was a sociopathic personality. And I think there's no other way to describe this than to say that the Pope was deceived.
It took him 17 years to say his first negative words about something called the sex scandal. He was hiding it. It was part of the policy that dated all the way back to 1922. The official Vatican policy was it didn't happen. There's an American author who at one point during the early years of the scandal in 2002 said, "I don't think there is a single American priest who was ever guilty of abusing a child." Well, he was wrong by about 10,000. John Paul II was in denial. He was in denial because he loved the priesthood and he didn't want anything to sully the idea of the priesthood. And so you had to cover up. And that was part of Vatican policy. We only kind of guess it by reason of his inaction for 17 years before finally, I believe it was as late as 2005, I could be wrong on the date, but he finally admitted that there was a problem.
All too many people remember how Pope Wojtyła had protected the pedophile Viennese Cardinal Hermann Gruhe, the successor of the great Cardinal König. Even though the Austrian Bishops' Conference was convinced of Gruhe's guilt, the Pope had also protected another Austrian friend, Kurt Krenn, Bishop of St. Pölten, who did not step down until he came under great public pressure following reports about homosexual activities by the seminarians and staff of the diocesan seminaries. Everybody knows also the case of Cardinal Bernard Law, who was practically deposed as Cardinal Boston, but was made Archbishop of the Basilica of Santa Maria Maggiore. That is only one of the indications that John Paul II was ready to forgive his loyal servants every kind of misdemeanor and failing.
John Paul II, having appointed conservative-minded bishops all over the world, people who were almost instinctively likely to play safe, to avoid scandal, to find easy solutions, for example, where a priest was accused of paedophilia, to move him to another area. And at no point did the Vatican question this policy or raise a doubt about the wisdom of it. And it seemed to me that Pope John Paul II was really not able to get his mind round the fact that this was happening. I mean, to be fair, perhaps, because of his holiness, he was incapable of understanding how a priest could do such things. And so I think he never really gave the problem anything like the attention it deserved. He had no idea what the scale of it was, because some of the questions of what had gone wrong touched on some of his core beliefs, so they were not open for debate. So I think that in many respects, he did the church harm by failing to recognize what was happening on the degree of it and the scale of it, and by putting in place people who were really not up to the job of dealing with it.
I think the problem with the canonization of John Paul II is the unresolved legionnaire question and his attitude towards sexual abuse in the church. How much did he really know? I don't pretend to have an answer to that, but it will not serve the church well if we try to suppress the thought that there is still a question here, whether or not he himself hadn't overlooked the sexual abuse crisis, and that if he had been willing to accept the testimony of the men involved and counselors in the church itself who were trying to alert him to this, we may not have had to go through what we're still in the midst of where that's concerned.
Oh, there are so many what ifs in the history of the church, aren't there? And one is, what would it have been like had there been women in power when the issue of child sexual abuse was first addressed? I think all the abuse actually ultimately was about an abuse of power. In the case of men, it came out in sexual abuse. In the case of women, the sisters, it came out in violence and cruelty. Who could have stopped that? I don't know. It would be lovely to say if there'd been women bishops, it would not have happened. But I can't be sure.
Former British nun Lavinia Byrne. Here in Australia, where we don't have women priests or bishops either, of course, we in the media were in a bit of denial about the abuse crisis too. Geraldine Doogue again.
Well, it was the mother down in Wollongong of a boy who had been sexually abused. The whole Wollongong story was a big shock to me. And the nature of the systemic problems, what I saw was what it had done to that fine Catholic family and that gritty, resourceful mother. And it had left her, in fact, she wrote to me again recently, it had left her pretty bitter. And it was insidious in that Wollongong diocese.
Has it challenged your own personal commitment and faith?
I think gradually it has definitely had an undermining effect on my commitment to say weekly Mass. The hierarchy's loss of face is pretty massive. It's pretty massive here in Australia, let alone overseas. And I think that the system needs us laity to step up now. And that's a bit of a challenge.
John Paul II, mystic and superstar to conservatives. To progressives, the celebrity facade was all sizzle and no sausage. The best of times and the worst of times, as Clifford Longley put it. His biographer, George Weigel, believes John Paul II left the church in America stronger.
Change has been slower in some parts of Western Europe, of continental Western Europe, because the problems are deeper there. Problems of radical secularism are deeper there. But the Catholic hierarchy in the United States is in far better shape, evangelically, in its capacity to speak to public life today than it was 30 or 40 years ago. And if that is not understood, then I'm afraid people simply aren't paying sufficient attention. They're simply dealing with these things out of those old liberal conservative biases that really are not too useful in sorting out the life of the Catholic Church. The greatest legacy of John Paul II is the witness of his own life. At the end of his life, he taught the entire world, not just the Catholic Church, an extraordinary lesson in human dignity. And he did it by the way he lived through his last days, by the way he lived through his suffering, and by the way he invited the whole world into an experience of what Christians call the Paschal Mystery, the death and resurrection of Jesus Christ, as that which gives meaning to our own suffering and death.
In my country, Sunday Mass is obligatory, but there aren't enough Catholic priests to supply mass in every parish. Had there been the ordination of women, we would not have churches that are starved of the sacraments, because there simply aren't enough young men coming forward who are prepared to be celibate and prepared to labour on their own. I think there's a twofold issue here. There is, of course, a simple solution. Ordain women and the church would get more user-friendly. That's a very nice, comforting, positive reading of the situation. But I do think there's a second question, and nobody has the courage to name it. It's about the recognition of homosexuality and homosexual priests. Those members of the church who are homosexual, whether they're clergy or lay people, they remain unacknowledged, unrecognized, undervalued.
Boy, it's been a hard time to be handing on the deposit of faith. I tried to say, so I had two stepchildren and two of my own, and very involved with all of them. And, of course, there's now two grandchildren. And I think about the grandchildren big time. I think we're living in such a time, who knows where the heck it's going.
Catholic in-house arguments over John Paul's legacy aside, does he deserve to be canonized?
Well, popes are not canonized because of their policies. They're canonized because of their relationship with God.
There are far too many unanswered questions about John Paul II and about his pontificate for the church to hurriedly promote his canonization. And I think we should have let a decent level of time go by so that these questions could be addressed and clarified. I'm sure he was a very saintly man, but saint? Not so sure.
No, look, I think he doesn't deserve to be a saint because I suppose I feel he embodied, as well as the great sense of life-giving, he embodied the fear. I felt his timing was wrong. Ultimately, I like the church to prove that it believes that it's not standing on the abyss of forces that it can't control, that it does believe that there's a sort of a power that comes from yielding and from believing that you will be rescued by the word of God. And I just didn't feel he did that.
Making saints is essentially a Catholic business. It's certainly not the business of the Jewish people to tell the Catholic Church who its saints are or who its saints are not. And there is, of course, an internal Catholic procedure for this. But in terms of the way the Jewish people felt about John Paul II, they had canonized him a long time before the Catholic Church had.
I think the people of the church decided that he was a saint on the day of his funeral. This was a life of heroic virtue. It deserves to be lifted up as an example for all to emulate.
You've been listening to An Encounter with Pope John Paul II. Noel Debien presented, the production team, Peter Kirkwood, Stephen Crittenden, Claire Delaney and others.